This is the Be Better Broadcast, your show for new strategies, ideas, and philosophies that will elevate your life and career to the next level. I'm your host, Brandon Eastman. Through conversations with experts, as well as my own studies and reflections, the Be Better Broadcast is designed to help you be better in every area of your life. Are you ready to be better? Let's rock and roll. Welcome to the Be Better Broadcast. Recently, we spoke to a man named Michael Amster on the show, and we talked about the power of awe. And he introduced me to his co-author of The Power of Awe. His name is Jake Eagle. He's tuning in all the way from Hawaii to share his insights, specifically his insights on how to make the most out of your life. For those of you who don't know Jake Eagle is a coach, a mentor, and he was a licensed psychotherapist for 2.5 decades. Now he refers to himself as a meta therapist, coaching and mentoring people to see what's possible beyond therapy. While Jake believes that therapy has its place, it also has its limitations. For 15 years, he's been conducting retreats around the world, gathering small groups of 20 people at a time and living together in community, learning and practicing how to live and love consciously. We're going to talk about what those two things mean. But when you take away even just one thing from this conversation with Jake Eagle today, all that we ask is you please share this show with just one other person who could use it as well. You are the reason the broadcast has grown to nearly 400 episodes because you are the best part of the Be Better team. Without further ado, all the way from Hawaii, Jake, it's great to have you here, sir.
Aloha. Nice to be with you. And I appreciate you doing it at this time because normally I'd have to get up at 2 a.m. to meet with
you. Yeah, no, I hear you. No, it's my pleasure. I'm glad that you're able to come on the show. You're our first guest from Hawaii. We've had several who grew up there and lived there, but you're the first one who's actually there. And for those watching, you'll see that both Jake and I, we dressed for the occasion today. So I was wondering if you would. We did not coordinate this, but it worked out in a beautiful way. So it's good to have you here. So thanks. Let's kick this off. I'm curious to ask you, in your introduction, you wrote, and this is a theme of yours, to live and love consciously. What does it mean to live consciously?
Well, to live consciously is to get off of autopilot. And for the most part, I think we tend to live on autopilot. We get into habitual routines and we just go along without really stopping and thinking about, am I the person that I was 10 years ago, which is when I may have adopted certain behaviors, I may have adopted certain beliefs. Are those still appropriate today? I may be in a relationship today that I wasn't in 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Am I treating the person that I'm with today in a way that aligns with my values today? Do I even know what my values are today? When's the last time that I reevaluated my values, my beliefs, the stories that I tell, because we're always making up stories. And the idea for me, and this is work that I've been doing for about 30 years, the idea is not to just do this reevaluation every so often, you know, once a year, every 5 years, whatever. But moment by moment, as we go through the day, as we're interacting with people, to stop and reflect, how am I treating you? Am I treating you in a way that I end up feeling good about after our interaction is over? Am I treating you in a way that hopefully calls forth the best in you? Or am I treating you in a way where you don't feel seen or maybe you don't feel safe? So all of these things go into the idea of living consciously.
So living consciously is a manner of living in which you have awareness of the stories you tell yourself, the values that you keep, how you're treating other people. Now, when you say, you ask yourself the question, how am I treating you? Are you asking yourself that question in every conversation that you have with people, even the quick drive-by conversations that you have with a store clerk or anybody?
I absolutely am. at a certain point, the question recedes to the background. It's not as if I need to remember to ask it because I do it all the time. But yesterday, my wife and I were in Kona, which is about an hour away. We were driving home, came to a stoplight. There's I assume he was probably homeless gentleman there. He's looking to get money. He's got a sign. And the sign talks about the fact that he has taken responsibility to clean up an area on the highway. And I thought, that's great. That's a really good way to market himself and to try and generate some income. So we gave him some money, but I also took a moment to thank him and to say, I appreciate what you're doing, helping clean up the neighborhood. So yeah, it happens all the time, this idea of being self-reflective and aware of how I interact with people.
Have you always been this way where you took that into account? Like, when did you start? Because awareness, like you said, most of us are on autopilot. We'll be driving home from a 30-minute commute and we don't remember the drive, right? Awareness is a muscle that we have to build. And I'm working on this. I'm very flawed in it, very flawed in it. When did this become a priority for you to live consciously and become more aware?
Yeah, I think when I was 7.
Wow, really?
Well, I mean, I'm laughing because I didn't know what I was doing when I was 7. And I think a lot of this is born out of my own insecurities. So I remember being very young and being hyper aware of people around me and tuning into, were they relaxed? Were they comfortable? And of course, the obvious question, you know, did they like me? Did they accept me? Did I feel comfortable around them? But I spent a lot of time trying to understand the dynamics of what's going on between me and other people, as well as other people that where I'm not even part of the conversation. And it's been a drive most of my life to find ways to, I think it's two pieces to it. One is to make myself and other people comfortable. However, I also tend to be fairly challenging. And that's the second part, which is to bring forth the best in myself and other people. That's just been a natural, strong drive that I've had since I was quite young.
Do you believe it's our responsibility to bring out the best in other people?
It's a choice. I think that our culture and our planet would be better off if we chose to think about how do we bring forth the best in ourselves and other people. What else are we doing here? What's the
point? It's true. Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. And I find that the people who do have a focus on bringing out the best in other people tend to live better lives themselves. And when I say better, I mean they have more quote unquote success in their physical body, maybe their finances, their relationships, maybe just one of those areas. But I find that those people tend to be more what many would say fulfilled when they have a focus on helping other people. Like if I just shut my show down tomorrow, I would lose a giant piece of me by doing so, because this show has become a part of my identity. It's a part of the way that I give back, share voices like yours to people who might never have heard those voices.
Yeah, well, I definitely relate to what you're saying, because I was a therapist for almost 30 years in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And then Hannah and I moved to Hawaii in 2017, and I more or less closed my practice down and lost a huge sense of my identity, and actually found it very difficult. I found the adjustment to moving here, which is ironic because it's a fabulous place to move to. And I was with a fabulous partner and we built a wonderful home. So everything looked great on the outside, but that sense of identity that I got from working with people decreased significantly. And it's taken me a while to sort of figure out, how do I replace that? Where do I look to get a sense of self?
What's up, Be Better family? It's Brandon Eastman here. And as a thank you for tuning in to the Be Better broadcast, I want to give you a very special gift. For a limited time, you can get a free digital copy of my book titled Be Extraordinary, Your Guide to Self-Mastery. This book is packed with insights and actionable steps that will help you to unlock your fullest potential in the 5 key areas of your life. But that's not all. Along with the book, I also want to give you the audiobook version absolutely
free. Imagine having the power to transform your life right at your fingertips and in your ears anytime, anywhere. Go grab your copy at bebetterindustries.com/book. You'll also find the link in the episode show notes. Go and grab your copy and join me in making a positive impact on the world. Now back to the show.
Okay, so let's talk about that idea of identity, because earlier you mentioned that we tell ourselves the same stories that we've told ourselves for years and years and years. If we think about what stories are, and correct me if I'm wrong, stories are identity, right? We create these ideas of who we are, whether they are true or not. We might see it one way, someone else might see it a different way, but it's our life. So really all that matters is how we see it, because that's what we manifest, that's what we live out. So when it comes to identity, how do you craft a new identity? How do you replace that part of you that disappeared in 2017 when you went to Hawaii? Does it take this long? So it's been 7 years now. How do you form a new identity or fill in the space that used to be there from a past identity?
So the first thing is to be aware of how we create our identity. You know, you could talk about it in terms of what is my identity. But if you go a level deeper, which is what you're asking about, it's how do I reinforce that identity every day? And a lot of it does have to do with the stories that I tell. It has to do greatly with how I interact and behave toward other people and how I talk to myself. It doesn't always manifest as a story. Sometimes we talk to ourselves with a simple label. You know, we may have a label of, that was stupid. Why did I say that? That kind of thing is going to impact our identity. People with a certain kind of identity will talk in a self-critical voice. People with a different identity don't talk in a self-critical voice. When they make a mistake, they will say something like, I wonder what I need to learn from this. That's a different identity. And so where this begins in my mind is realizing that our identity is malleable. It's made up. It's not fixed. And part of the problem with English language, as well as many others, is that we talk in a way where we make things sound as if they're static and permanent. I am blank, whatever it is. I am angry. Well, maybe I'm making myself angry in this moment, but that doesn't mean that I am angry and that it's in concrete. It's just a temporary state. It's a temporary emotion. Beliefs come and go. So part of my work is about teaching people to use language in a way where they are constantly recognizing and reminding themselves, this is in process. It's all temporary, and I'm making up meaning. That doesn't mean it's not valid, but I'm making up meaning. I'm interpreting things moment to moment. And there's a great quote from Viktor Frankl, who was the author of Man's Search for Meaning. And his quote is that between any stimulus and the response, there's a space. And in that space is our opportunity for freedom and personal power. So the idea is that when I experience a stimulus, somebody does something to me, before I respond, that's the moment where I have choice. That's the moment where I can shape my response. I can be very deliberate about the words I choose. I can recognize that somebody may accuse me of something that I don't think is true. And I have the opportunity to realize, well, this is their perception. This is their interpretation. Not necessarily my interpretation, but we all interpret events and the world subjectively. And so I don't have to be defensive. I don't have to react from my reptilian brain. And this is what's happening a great deal of the time, is that people think of their identity as if it's their physical being, as if it's their body. And when it's threatened, they often react by going to fight, flight, or freeze, which, you know, tens of thousands of years ago that was an appropriate response. If a tiger comes out of the bushes, fight, flight, or freeze is really all we can choose. But today, somebody may challenge your identity or challenge your belief, and fight, flight, or freeze is not an appropriate response. It's not a helpful response, but we tend to go there very rapidly.
Yeah, because we're on autopilot, and that's a primal response.
Yeah, and it's also because a lot of us, we were never educated about the fact that meaning is subjective. It's made up. We're each interpreting things in our own way. And if we can develop that awareness and hold that meta awareness, we simply relax and become more curious. Why does a person accuse me of something that I think is ridiculous? Why would somebody say I was a liar if I was telling the truth?
Yeah.
Well, now I'd be curious and say, why do you see me that way? What pieces are you putting together, instead of going to a place of indignation, defensiveness, or aggression?
Yeah, very interesting. So easier said than done, for sure, because like you said, most people, including myself, we weren't trained on these things. We weren't taught these things. I remember when I first discovered even the inner voice and like some of the things that you've mentioned already was when I went to a seminar in Florida for neuro-linguistic programming in 2019. So this is just 5 years ago. And I went to the seminar. It was taught by Richard Bandler. And we learned for 8 days NLP and anchoring and all these different exercises and ways of thinking and deletion and beliefs and all these things and a lot that you've already mentioned. And I was thinking to myself, why weren't we taught these things? Like, this way of thinking came out in the 80s, maybe even earlier. So it blows my mind. And you were a therapist for many, many years. And now you say that you like to help people go beyond therapy. And you've labeled yourself in your introduction here, I just want to make sure I'm getting it right. You've labeled yourself as a meta therapist. Now, I don't know what that means. What's the difference between a therapist and a meta therapist?
So several things you've touched on that are interesting to me. The difference between a therapist and a meta-therapist is that it's also the difference between cognition, which is how we think, and metacognition, which is thinking about how we think. They're very different levels. So therapy typically occurs at a certain level of consciousness that I call safety consciousness, and I'll explain that more in a few minutes. A meta-therapist stops and recognizes the level of consciousness that the client is at and determines whether working at that level is appropriate and helpful or not. Very often, it's more helpful to go to a different level of consciousness as a way to gain different perspectives before trying to address the so-called problem. So meta-therapist carries with them a very distinct awareness of what level is this person operating at, and is that the level to stay at right now, or should we shift the level of consciousness, which I can tell you about in a bit. When a person has a problem, more often than not, they've created it at this level of safety consciousness. And safety consciousness, by the way, is where most of us live most of the time. It's when our orientation to the world is one of getting things done, making ourselves feel safe, taking care of our loved ones, basically checking off the boxes that we check off every day. And it's absolutely essential to live there. And the reality is that what we want to do is get very good at that, which is what a great deal of therapy and NLP is about. But we don't want to limit ourselves to that level of consciousness because it makes us small. There's so much more possibility. There's so many more ways of connecting and relating and being in the world. But we have to step out of that level of consciousness. And we can talk about how you do that. The other thing I just want to touch on, you mentioned NLP, and I was a NLP trainer for probably 15 years. Along with a colleague, I actually took NLP to Japan in the late 90s, we introduced NLP to Japan. So wow. I'm a huge believer in it. I think it's extremely valuable. I wish we were teaching it to kids at a young age. But again, it has a certain limitation. It's very, it's sort of mechanical. You know, here are these three steps to do if you want to change a belief. And they work, but they don't necessarily look at the larger context where people try to understand where does the belief come from? How does it serve me? It's not just that I want to change the belief. I want to connect it also to my identity. Is the new belief I'm trying to create going to keep me feeling safe and secure in ways that are good for me or ways that are limiting for me? So I'm trying to paint a broader picture, one that empowers people to get out of this level of safety consciousness.
Do you believe it matters where a belief comes from if you can change it to something that is more empowering? And how do you know if a belief is good for you? Like, you can have a belief that you believe might be good for you, but after you adopt that belief, you find out that it's not good for you and you learn the hard way. So how can you know that?
So, excuse me, two things. I don't think it matters where a belief comes from. To me, it's not a factor. And I think we oftentimes in therapy, we place too much emphasis on that. We look at a belief that was born out of trauma and we assume that that belief is embedded in the person. People even talk about it being embedded at a cellular level. Maybe it is, maybe it's not, but the reality is I still want to change it. So does it matter where it came from? I don't think so. The second part of your question has to do with thinking about the person that I want to be. Does this belief help me be the person that I want to be or not? And then the other part is evidence. I need to look at the evidence in my life. So I may assume that it would be good for me to have a belief that helped me become more extroverted because I'm actually rather introverted. Maybe I'm disappointed, frustrated about going through life as an introvert. So I think, well, I want to develop a belief that will help me be an extrovert. Okay. I also need to look at the evidence. As I start to behave in new ways, is that working for me? What impact does that have on my existing relationships, which I formed as an introvert? Maybe it's not a good idea for me to change this belief. So I need to be very conscious. We go back to the idea of living consciously and taking in feedback and evaluating myself in a what I would say is with critical thinking. I don't mean being critical of myself, but I mean thinking in a really thoughtful, deliberate manner. Is this a change that I should and want to make in my life?
Would you equate living consciously with questioning everything, even the thoughts that are running through our head?
Yeah, I think so. I do think that's right. I want to have a caveat, which is that makes it sound like a lot of work, you know, constantly questioning myself.
It's true.
But as we become comfortable with this and we start to relax, it doesn't feel like work. I often have couples come in and they'll say, you know, we have a relationship and we push each other's buttons and we know that's good because that forces us to grow. And I don't really believe in that model. I don't think that life being hard necessarily is necessary for us to grow. I don't think we need to be in difficult relationships to grow. Mm. I actually believe that we grow more when we feel safe and we're able to relax.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. So I want to revisit this idea of safety consciousness, but before we do, there's a lot of people in the world, and especially today, a lot of people rediscovering who they are. Maybe they lost their job, they started their own business, they're trying to find something new. And you've met many of these people as a therapist, I'm sure, who say, Jake, I am not happy where I am. I want to become more disciplined because I want to do this. I want to be more conscientious because I want to do this. I want to be a better husband, a better wife, whatever it may be. How do you begin to help people to shift their identity? Is the first step determining what or who you want to be? Where do you begin?
I think it differs depending on where the person is at, depending on how rigid they are, how stuck they are. If they're extremely rigid or they're very attached to their identity, then I would want to start to introduce activities, not just talk therapy, but activities that give them a broader, fuller sense of who they could be. So to have them do things that are outside of their normal behavior patterns. And if people are more relaxed and open and curious, then I think the process is quicker. But one of the greatest obstacles to growth is repression. We often hold down or push down feelings that we don't want to experience or beliefs that feel dangerous to even consider. And so I try to create an environment for people where it's completely acceptable to explore those feelings or explore those beliefs. And the primary way that occurs is, as a therapist, the primary way that occurs is through their interaction with the therapist. In other words, if the therapist is able to explore a belief that a client has where the client is extremely self-critical, and what a therapist typically will do is they will say, well, there's nothing wrong with that belief, right? That's just something that you adopted and we can work on that. What I do is I play on a little bit larger playing field, and I'll play the role of the person who's critical. Why do that? Well, because it helps the client get in touch with their own feeling. It helps them get in touch with their own internal criticism. Now, to do that, to work with people in that way, you have to believe in people. You have to see them as resilient. You have to be relaxed yourself. And that's probably one of the concerns I have about a lot of therapy and coaching is the angst that the coach or the therapist brings to the interaction.
Mm.
And that's why I think as a therapist or a coach, it's incredibly important that we do our work, that we are congruent, that we feel comfortable in our own skin. Now, sometimes we start out doing this in our 30s and it may feel like, well, I'm not quite there yet. But it can be done incrementally. We can get to a place where, you know, given that I don't have a lot of experience, what is it that I am comfortable working on? What kind of people am I comfortable working with? So a lot of this to me comes back to creating a context that allows people to open up, to express, to explore.
So you mentioned, you know, when in your 30s, you might not be 100% comfortable in your own skin. Do you believe that being comfortable in your own skin only comes from age? Does it come from experience? What do you mean by that?
I think predominantly it's developmental, that each decade of life, assuming we're conscious and we're working on ourselves and this is our intention, I think each decade of life we become more comfortable. But there are exceptions. I mean, if you look at two 20-year-olds, one can be extremely comfortable and the other can be rather ill at ease with who they are. And this is, of course, it's why people often go into therapy, is they're not comfortable with who they are. And then they are interested in this work. They become fascinated about it. And then they actually become a therapist.
Mm.
I'm not sure that's the best reason. I think it fosters a kind of self-indulgence, which is one of my concerns with therapy today. We see a lot of self-indulgence, and therapy often encourages it. And there's not, you know, you and I are talking about being self-reflective and observant of our own behavior and our own beliefs. But how far you take that can determine whether it's constructive or not. As soon as you start working really hard at this and becoming obsessed and become thinking about yourself all the time, I don't think it's any longer, it's not constructive at that point. It has a constrictive quality to it. And my thinking about therapy is we don't want to help people constrict or become more rigid. We want to help people open up and become more relaxed and more comfortable.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about that. You mentioned this concept of safety consciousness. How do you help someone to then expand their consciousness beyond safety? Because you mentioned safety is important, but you want there to be more than just that.
So the simple way of doing this, there's a few components to it, but the simple way is just basic education, which is letting people know that based on the model that my wife and I have created and been using for 20 years, there are three levels of consciousness we've identified. Safety, you and I talked about. We all live there. We spend a lot of time there. But there's also something that we all have done, and particularly when we were kids, which is to live in something called heart consciousness, which is where we're just joyful. We're playing. We're appreciating life. We're appreciating the world. We're appreciating a new toy that we may have. We're not bringing the judgmental aspects to our lives. We're just in a state of appreciation. And when we do that, we shift our physiology. And heart consciousness is very well documented by an organization called HeartMath. You may be familiar with them. HeartMath has a simple way of helping people access this different physiological state. And it's very easy to do. And essentially what you're doing is you're thinking about things that you appreciate while simultaneously focusing on breathing from the region of your body where your heart is, from your chest. And if you're hooked up to biofeedback and you do this, you immediately see a shift in your breathing pattern and your heart rate variability. So it's not hard to go into heart consciousness. We can find things that we appreciate no matter what's going on around us. So that's the second level of consciousness. And as soon as we go there, everything looks different. We're in a different state. We have different filters. We have different values. And we can look at what was a problem in safety consciousness, and it no longer looks the same. It still may be a problem, but we see it from a different perspective. And that's loosened up our ideas about what was previously this problem. The next level of consciousness is called spacious consciousness. And the book that Michael Amster and I wrote called The Power of Awe has in it a methodology to help us access spacious consciousness. This is something that mystics and spiritual teachers have been working on for, you know, thousands of years, helping people access what is probably considered a high contemplative state. Meditation is certainly a way to do it. But the traditional journey is a long one. It's arduous. It takes years to become good at that. And I see the, you know, the Be Better sign behind you. It's very much about a state of being instead of a state of doing. And Be Better is actually appropriate because it's being, but being in a way that's better for us and better for everyone.
Oh, I like that.
When we go into this state of spacious consciousness, words drop away, which means judgment drops away, stories drop away, and time drops away. It's a timeless state. It's a state of feeling suspended and connected with something greater than ourselves. And as soon as we do that, everything shifts physiologically as well as emotionally. Now, if we try to talk about it while we're in spaciousness, we can't stay in spaciousness. So what we do is we visit this state to gain a very different perspective. And then we come back to heart or safety consciousness, but with a very different relationship to ourselves and the world. We've opened ourselves up in a vast way, and which, by the way, is what happens when we experience the emotion of awe.
Yeah.
And so this is what was so profound in the work that Michael and I did, is we created a 10, 15, 20 second method called the AWE method that helps people quickly go into a state of spacious consciousness. And what we did in our research study is we asked people to do that three times a day, and each time takes, let's say, 20 seconds. So over the course of a day, it may be a minute.
Yeah.
And we saw these remarkable results. I won't repeat all of them because you did a show with Michael, but at the high level, it reduces depression, anxiety, loneliness. It actually reduces inflammation in the body, which is extraordinary. And the reason this is so powerful is that the emotion of awe is known as a pro-social emotion. What that means is that it makes it easier for us to connect with other people and to connect with something larger than ourselves. And when we do that, well, I would just encourage you or your listeners to imagine being in a state of timelessness where there are no words, there's just pure presence.
Mm.
And if you just even briefly consider that, I suspect you'll feel some shift in your mind or your body or both.
Yeah. That's how I felt when I was on magic mushrooms.
Yeah. Well, magic mushrooms, was it Michael Pollan who wrote the book on this?
I think so. That sounds familiar.
Change Your Mind. I'm not quite sure about the title, but he talks a lot about awe. And he was using psychedelics. He was investigating people who were using psychedelics to access this state of expanded consciousness. And I was very familiar with his work before Michael and I really kind of stumbled onto this idea of awe as a way to experience something very similar to what people experience when they use psychedelics. The difference is you're not using any psychedelics and it only lasts a very brief amount of time.
But you can access it whenever you want to with that three-step process. So for those who haven't watched the episode with Michael Amster, the AWE is an acronym, so AWE. The first step is to bring your attention and find awe in the ordinary things around you, something that you can be appreciative for, something that you can spot no matter where you are right now. Even if it's in a darkly lit room, you can find something and bring your attention to this thing. The W is wait and be with this thing and marinate with this thing. And the E is to exhale and expand. And specifically, we go into each one of those steps in our episode together. So I'll put a card up in the corner of this episode if you're watching on YouTube. If you're listening to the podcast, I can't do that, but it'll be in the description below. You can check out that full episode. Okay, so to recap what you mentioned here, those three levels of consciousness: safety consciousness, which is necessary; heart consciousness, which we experience much as a child when we get a new toy; and three, spacious consciousness, which is where the power of awe brings us. So I'm a bit confused with the difference between heart and spacious consciousness. Well, what's the main difference between those two?
So we access heart consciousness by thinking about things that we appreciate. So think about the person in your life that you appreciate the most. Just think about that person and how fortunate you are to have that person in your life. And what will happen is you'll begin to sense a shift, physiological shift. Breathing patterns change, posture changes. And if you were to speak, you'd notice that people use language differently when they're in heart consciousness. So notice that I'm guiding you through this by using words and we're talking. If we were to go to spacious consciousness, the words drop away. So we're no longer thinking our way through. We're accessing a state. And that's when the words and the sense of time drop away. And then we're just in a state of pure presence, no longer thinking. And so it becomes effortless to be in a state of what I would call either spacious consciousness or pure presence. We think only briefly to direct ourselves in that direction, to encourage us to go there. And then what we're doing is we're letting go. And this ties back to the earlier part of our conversation. What are we letting go of? We're letting go of our identity. We're letting go of our beliefs. We're letting go of our judgmental thoughts because they are no longer present. And we experience ourselves in this spacious way that is probably similar for everybody, regardless of culture or background. It's some universal experience that people have. Sometimes it's through contemplative practice. Sometimes it's through religion or prayer. Doesn't really matter how we get there. But the point in terms of our conversation is that we don't want to simply work on our problems or issues from one level of consciousness, but learn to move around. The idea is not to live in spacious or live in heart consciousness. We really probably couldn't do that, but it's to become fluid. It's to move effortlessly. And you can use these very proactively, Brandon. Let's just imagine that you have a challenging conversation that you want to have with your life partner. Well, where do most people go? They go into safety consciousness. They furrow their brow. They think, what do I need to say? What if he or she responds in this way? What if it doesn't go well? And these are all appropriate questions, but they create a certain tone before the conversation ever takes place. If instead you went into a state of heart consciousness and just thought about how much you appreciate having this person in your life, regardless of whatever it is you need to work on, if you just connected with how much you appreciate them, and by the way, if they knew how to do this too, so you could say to them, why don't we both take a minute, go into heart consciousness, and then let's sit down and have this conversation. It's a completely different conversation.
Wow.
It starts with warmth and care and appreciation. And yes, we have a difference. And yes, we need to resolve it. And yes, maybe we won't both get everything we want, but we're coming at it from a completely different orientation.
Yeah, I think that makes it very practical for people to see how it can serve them in their own life. So if you were having that conversation with somebody, rather than educate them on, before we have this conversation, let me educate you on the three levels of consciousness. Is there value in just one person going into heart consciousness to have that difficult conversation even still?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, you know, the way mirror neurons work is that the individual who has a more stable and congruent nervous system, that nervous system will carry the conversation because the other person will attune to your nervous system. So if you can enter a state of heart consciousness and be very congruent and fully embody that quality, and the other person may be anxious about the conversation, they will attune to your nervous system. Now, they might not be there 100%, but they'll move in your direction.
Yeah.
And as soon as you take yourself into heart consciousness, your nervous system is going to shift into a different vibration, a different state. And literally, it changes the chemicals in your body and in your brain.
Very, very interesting. Guys, if you want more information on this, be sure to grab The Power of Awe, because that will help you to enter this state of spacious consciousness. It'll give you the three-step process, where it came from. You mentioned the study. That study was with UC Berkeley that you did that study with. Is that correct?
That's right. We did it at the height of the pandemic, and we did it with a little over 200 frontline healthcare workers and 300 wow. patients and family members. So it was a fairly large study with very significant results.
That's amazing. Super cool. So be sure to go check that out, guys. The link is in the description below. So you're working on something very interesting nowadays that you called transformational tales.
Right.
What exactly is that?
So transformational tales is a series. It's six booklets. They're very short. Each one is, I think, 30, maybe 40 pages. And it ties back in a way to NLP, but the NLP is not obvious. It's all conversational. It's in the background. But the point is that it's encouraging people to go through a process, and it's by reading a story. It's a series of short stories. And as part of the journey, you read the first booklet, and then you get eight audio recordings, one every other day over 2 weeks. Then you go online, you answer some questions, you demonstrate, I've read this, I understand this. Then the next booklet begins. And you go through this process. It takes about 2 months. It's fun. It's humorous in ways. It's engaging. all of which is very intentional because, as I said to you earlier, people learn best when they're relaxed. And so I've created a course that has embedded in it principles of neuroscience that allow people to be relaxed and comfortable and read about experiences that help them integrate new ideas and new concepts without feeling guarded, without feeling like they have to work hard, without any kind of need to self-justify why you do what you do or why you are the way you are. None of that comes up. And so essentially what I'm doing is I'm inviting people to work at a different level of consciousness. And I'm helping people move through. Some of it's in safety, and some of it's in heart, and some of it's in spaciousness. And then the spaced repetition, because you're doing this over a period of 2 months, allows people to integrate the learning.
Okay.
Compared to doing a weekend course, or compared to doing reading a self-help book in, you know, 4 days and being done with it. My concern with those things is that we just don't allow ourselves to get deeply immersed and integrate the lessons.
So you do it through these, what you call transformational tales or stories.
Yes.
And after the stories, you get actual audio recordings as well. And then once you've shown that you've downloaded this material, you can go to the next stage.
Exactly. Yeah.
And this is 2 months of work.
Right.
Well, work might not be the best word.
Two months of play.
2 months. Exactly. I knew you were going to say something when I said work. Yep. Cool. So is this something that you've already released? Is this a course that's already out there people can go check out?
Yes, it is. I think actually the page that describes it will go up on, I think it's April. It's mid-April.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know when this is released, but probably by that time it will be available. And that's on the website, which is www.liveconscious.com. People often think it's live consciously, but it's liveconscious.com.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great website name, by the way. I'm surprised you got that website name. I'm surprised that wasn't taken. Or was it?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to say that's probably got a pretty penny on it, that website. I love that. Yeah. It's a great concept. I mean, we all hear of consciousness, and imagine if we could all implement these different ideas. Imagine, like what you said, we can help bring out the best in other people. And what would our world look like if we were able to shift between these states of consciousness? Other people would follow the lead, right? We become the leader once we're able to shift into these more empowering states. And a lot of people are followers, but imagine if they were following people who did shift between these, they could learn themselves. So at this point in your life, what are you looking to accomplish with the work that you're doing? What is the change that you really want to see in the world at this stage in your life?
Well, there are two answers to that. Personally, I want to get to a place where I'm no longer looking for or depending on external validation to feel good about myself. I used to get a lot of it. I now get a lot less. I'd like to be at a place where I don't require that, because it creates a dependency that does tend to make us anxious. We're always thinking, you know, will I be approved? Will I get what I want? Will I be successful? So that's my own personal agenda.
Yeah.
In terms of the world, I'm really hoping to do work with people that fosters kindness, that reminds people that we have the better angels of our nature, and if we can wake them up in ourselves and other people, we may be able to move through what I think is a very tumultuous time in our country and in the world. I wish that our leaders were more aware of this. I wish that our leaders were modeling it, but they're not. And so I think what happens is it comes back to us. We have to model this. The famous Gandhi quote that, you know, we have to be the change we want to see in the world. And so my work is predominantly helping other people who want to do this by giving them tools that make it possible.
Who are some leaders or people that follow these principles closely that you've observed?
Well, if I tell you, then it'll bring a controversial tone to the
controversy. Is good.
Okay, so
Kennedy. Oh, excellent. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, oh, I agree.
I mean, a lot. You know, Kennedy. Yep. Robert Kennedy Jr. has gotten an enormous amount of negative press, and he's thought of as a conspiracy theorist. But if people will take the time to listen and really pay attention, this is a man who is trying to bring people together. He is focused on what we share in common, which are a lot of wonderful traits, and not focus on the things that divide us. And that's not true of most of our leaders.
It's true.
So I have enormous respect for him. I've been volunteering for him in Hawaii. Cool. And if you listen to his language, he's not tearing people down.
True.
He's speaking in a way, he's speaking respectfully about other people. And if viewers are interested and they don't know much about him, Lex Fridman did an interview with Kennedy. And if you search for that and you just search for Lex Fridman, Robert Kennedy, who is God, there's a 10-minute video clip where Kennedy talks about what God means to him. And it's not a religious version of God, but it's absolutely a beautiful description of what's possible and how to live a healthy, responsible life.
Yeah.
So he's an example of a leader. Yeah.
Great. I'm glad that I asked you that, because that's a great example. And there's no denying he's a sharp man. He takes care of himself. You mentioned, you know, taking care of yourself is of the utmost importance. He takes care of himself, and he isn't afraid to admit if he was wrong at any point. I mean, he's open to changing views, and if you can show him why it's right, he'll take that viewpoint. And I've enjoyed his interviews, and I would agree with you 100%. So very cool. Nice. I love that. And I'll have that link for people in the description too. If you're on RFK or anything like that, you can go check it out. And if you heard what Jake said, and when he put the hat on and you felt a certain way about it, you may be operating out of a place of safety consciousness, right?
Operating out of safety consciousness, and absolutely. And one last thing to say about that is that that's where our confirmation biases exist. We all have biases, and oftentimes we're not aware of them. And so part of the conversation Brandon and I have had is becoming conscious means becoming conscious of our own biases. And we all have them. We all have them. So it's not as if we can escape them. It's about recognizing them and going, yeah, this is a bias I have.
Yeah.
And not to hold on to it too tightly, but to see it and go, yeah, that is a bias I have.
Yes. Awareness for what it is. 100%.
Right.
Excellent. Jake, this has been a lot of fun. So everyone listening, I'm going to have a link below to The Power of Awe. I'll have the RFK interview, but front and center, I'm going to have a link to The Transformational Tales. Okay. So by the time this launches, it will be down there. I'll have the link down there, and go check it out. See if it's for you. It's over the course of a few months. And again, like you said, it's not hard work. It's play, right? And I'm sure you make it so in a way that people are able to incorporate it into their life. Is that true?
That's absolutely right. That's the feedback I've gotten from people who've been doing it, that it's a very unique experience in terms of the personal growth world. Yeah.
Great. Very cool. Well, Jake, I'm really happy we made this happen. Shout out to you, Mike Amster, for connecting the two of us. And this was a lot of fun, sir. And I look forward to see what you continue to do. And I'm glad that we're connected. Thank you for being on the show.
All right. Thanks, Brandon.
This was an awesome conversation that added to the amazing conversation that Mike and I had. Again, I'll have that episode below too, so you can go check that out. We go deeper into The Power of Awe. But this conversation with Jake was different. I think we went a lot deeper into the mental aspect of awe. We talked about those three states of consciousness. We talked about how to create a new identity. We talked about how to find awareness and bring awareness and shift between these states. I mean, we went deep in this conversation, and I hope that there was one thing in this that was helpful for you that you'll use. And if you're saying to yourself, I want to get better at shifting between these three states, and I don't want to do it just by reading a book one time, then be sure to go check out the Transformational Tales in the description. And see if that's for you. Go check out the website. The link is right down there. And see if Jake can help take you to that next level. Thank you so much for watching and listening and for sharing this episode, because you are the best part of the Be Better team. And until we talk again next time, continue to be better.